Hello, my name is Bernadette Russell. Welcome to episode 6 of my podcast series, How to Be Hopeful, a podcast all about hope, where to find it, and how to keep it once you have found it. Today, I'm lucky enough to be speaking to my friend and colleague, Dominic Campbell. And by way of introduction to him and how we know each other, and a little bit about the kind of thing that we do, I'd like to read you a poem by Jenny Joseph called Warning, with thanks to the Scottish Poetry Library. When I am an old woman, I shall wear purple with a red hat which doesn't go and doesn't suit me. And I shall spend my pension on brandy and summer gloves and satin sandals and say, we've no money for butter. I shall sit down on the pavement when I'm tired and gobble up samples in shops and press alarm bells and run my stick along the public railings and make up for the sobriety of my youth. I shall go out in my slippers in the rain and pick flowers in other people's gardens and learn to spit. You can wear terrible shirts and grow more fat and eat 3 pounds of sausages at a go or only bread and pickle for a week and hoard pens and pencils and beer mats and things in boxes. But now we must have clothes that keep us dry and pay our rent and not swear in the street and set a good example for the children. We must have friends to dinner and read the papers. But maybe I ought to practice a little now, so people who know me are not too shocked and surprised when suddenly I am old and start to wear purple. And that's Warning by Jenny Joseph from Selected Poems, published by Blood Axe Books in 1992. Dominic and I met when we were both working at an arts club for the over 60s called Meet Me at the Albany, a club which was dreamt up by David Slater of Intellikey Arts and Gavin Barlow, who the artistic director of the Albany Theatre in Deptford, as well as involving lots of amazing people over 60 in the art club. It also involves a lot of artists, musicians, visual artists, theatre makers, poets. It's a fantastic place and a real inspiration. And I've been lucky enough to meet with and make friends with lots of people there. And Dominic's one of them. So I hope you enjoy our conversation.
So my name is Dominic Campbell, and I am mildly caffeinated, and I feel like I have one foot on the brake and the other one on the accelerator at the same time.
I should say, being mildly caffeinated at 1 o'clock in the afternoon is quite impressive.
Thanks. It was a good cup of coffee. It was quite strong. It's very long.
Brilliant. So when we met, and I speak a little bit about this in the intro, we worked together at Meet Me At, which is an arts club for the over 60s, just to summarise that. Could you just talk to us a little bit about your work since leaving Meet Me At and what you're up to now?
Sure. So I have to start a little bit before Meet Me. So
sure.
Before I was at Meet Me, I developed a festival here in Ireland called the Bealtaine Festival, which is a nationwide celebration of creativity as we age. So it's got a big focus on old people, but really on how we get older and what happens when we make things and all of that lovely stuff. And it's part of what I've been doing for a long time, which is using festivals for social connection or telling different kinds of stories, because festivals are amazing places for like new ideas or trying new things out. And really, that's what I picked up again after we were in Meet Me. But I did it slightly differently. So I also became, it's a very long title, a fellow with the Global Brain Health Institute, which is a program that runs between Trinity College in Dublin and UCSF in San Francisco, and is focused really on how do we do a better job of understanding Alzheimer's and dementias and all that neurodegenerative stuff. And I've been hanging out with lots of different types of scientists, bringing the arts and culture to them and figuring it out and going to festivals in different places and having a wild old time, really. It's been great.
excellent. We should have said, actually, you're actually speaking from Dublin at the moment, aren't
you? I am speaking from Dublin, yeah.
And is that your main... Do you mainly live in San Francisco now, or are you just like a flippity gibbet?
I am a flippity gibbet. I mostly live in a backpack, and but actually, one of the great things about COVID is it gives you a very quick choice to make a decision about where you feel home is, and so I am in what I think of as home. Home is Dublin, Ireland.
That's lovely. That's a lovely thought, actually, that it focuses our thoughts on where home is. Actually makes me think about people who aren't at where they think home is at the moment. That's also tricky, isn't it? Before we go into that, in more general terms, it seems to me, and it might be feel very differently or look very differently to you, that there's been an explosion in recent years of arts projects led by or including older people. And I wondered if you think that's the case, and if so, why you think that might be happening now?
So I think there has been an increase in work with, for, by older adults, and a beginning to be a deepening of the conversation. So partly why is it happening? Well, there are more people living longer, at least in some parts of the world, not in everywhere. There is a sense that some of those things that people got used to doing with young people and with, I don't know, marginalised communities, to use that language, might apply to older people. But I think there's something else going on, which is that working with older people in a particular kind of way now is about 20 years old, maybe in some cases a little bit older, and people are getting much more savvy about what that means. And so when I'm working in America, or when I'm working in the UK, or when I'm in Australia, and a couple of other places in Europe, there is, people talk about a field, which kind of amuses me, really. I think there is some growth, the idea, or mushrooms or something. And I'm not really sure there is a field yet. I think there is an increasing amount of stuff being done. There's the beginning to be a sense of what makes that good and bad and indifferent, and the variety of it. But I think we're only at the beginning of that bit, and about really understanding what that means. But I think it's mostly to do with the fact there are more people living longer.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? And also, you will have found, and I've certainly found, as I've worked, as I've been in it, sometimes it feels a little bit meaningless as a phrase, because one 70-year-old is in a completely different circumstances for any other 70-year-old, and then there is all the sort of organic, degenerative stuff that may or may not come into play, and physical stuff as well. So it's complex, and I think it's really important that it's acknowledged as such. I came across the expression, the age of creativity, which I thought was lovely, and I'll explain why to you in a moment. And I just want to describe it describes itself as a network of more than 1,000 professionals who say that creativity and culture supports older people to experience better health, well-being, and quality of life. Now, I love the expression age of creativity, because a lot of the older people I've worked with have said, I've been wanting to make puppets since I was 20, but I was busy being a parent or working. So for me, that's my connection with that, this sort of beautiful opportunity to actually get your hands dirty with things you didn't perhaps have the opportunity to get your hands dirty to. But I wondered what your experience has been of that in terms of the arts and creative practice improving older people's well-being and quality of life, and what ways they support older people. I know that's a big question to answer, but...
Yeah, so if I kind of dive into it a bit. So I think art and older people, what's really amazing, what's really unique. So the first thing is that arts are a way of exploring the world and your place in it. And if you spend a bit of time drawing with other people, or dancing, or making music, or you learn that there's no wrong, there's just your way of doing it, and you make a version, you make a better version. And I think when you work that way, if you give yourself time to sit and draw or dance or sing, or you realise that you make a version, you make a better version, but you're also doing something else. It's really subtle but really beautiful, and you're exploring your place in the world. And the older you get, the more your place in the world changes in all sorts of fantastic ways. So it might be that your movement changes. It might be that the way you think changes. It might be that you feel a bit invisible on the street. It might be that you get really canny. It might be. So things change. And what the arts does fundamentally is give people a place where they can explore that. And sometimes it's about doing it fun, and sometimes it's about investing some really significant emotion in that. And then what that adaptation, what that allows you to do in terms of health and well-being, is about adapting to the person that you are now and embracing all of that alongside the person you were when you were like 16. And that also gives you tools to do with resilience. How do you adapt? How well can you navigate your boat on a calm sea or on a stormy sea? And the thing that people don't talk about enough, I think, is there's this really great little documentary on Netflix for those people that watch that called The Black Godfather, which is all about a guy called Clarence Avant. And Clarence is a rainmaker. He's one of these people who's a kind of cultural producer and had lots of different roles. And at one point, he was responsible for keeping Soul Train going. You know Soul Train? So like Soul Train was like 5 till 5:30 TV, and it's basically people doing funky moves to soul music.
I mean, it's an absolute joy watching that.
And that's the point of it, okay? It's an absolute joy. So what we don't talk about enough, I think, in the arts is that the secret weapon is joy. It's about just more than fun. It's about exuberance and awe and how amazing life is. And that's the secret weapon. That's why the arts is so important in terms of health. It's about joy.
I'm interested. I'd agree with all of that. What interests me, I'll ask, I have what I think is the answer to this, but what you've said could surely apply to anyone at any age.
Yes.
So what I don't mean that to say that I sound like I'm disagreeing with you, but what would you say specifically, what specific positive aspects relate to being older? Yeah.
So the first thing is, I think aging is a really complex chronology. So it's not as simple as like, I am now 75, because depending on how you got to 75 depends on how life impacts on your body. But if we're talking about people who are old and also frail, then we can be really specific about it. And we can talk about ways of communication, and we can talk about poetic language, and we can talk about someone spending time with you in a way that tries to communicate, and artists are amazing at that. Whatever their basic skill set is, they are phenomenally intuitive and empathic, and so I think that is one of the unique pieces about older age, older frail age. But I think there's unique things about looking at life through the lens of old age. So one of the reasons I got really interested in working with older adults was because I fondly thought, and to an extent it's true, that things that people argued about all the way through the rest of their lives kind of get a bit irrelevant when you're a bit near to dying. And, you know, you might go, well, actually, I want to spend my time. So what I love with working with older adults is they vote with their feet. If they don't like it, they just decide not to turn up. It's like, that's fine. They're really got no time for wasting. You know, want to do something interesting, want to do something joyful or not. So I think one of the great things about making art with older people or for or watching it or by it is that it kind of reduces down to really important stuff. And that important stuff might be something really tiny, or it might be something massive, but it's just about it being valuable and not frippery. And it's not very often about people becoming famous or, you know, the star game. It's about something else. It's about why art is important in their lives. It's so important that it's worth doing.
Yes, it's interesting as well. And obviously this doesn't apply to everybody who is older, but one of the comparisons, because I sort of work at either end of the age range when I'm sort of doing community stuff, and I think one of the things that kids and older adults have in common is if they're lucky, they have time as well. I know that's not always the case either end, but actually it's quite commonly that people have time for the first time. And instead of that being a burden, because I think spare time can feel like a burden if you're experiencing an absence of purpose. But actually art, the sort of thing that you and I have been lucky enough to be part of, make turns that time into a spare time into an opportunity, or helps to turn that spare time into an opportunity. So I think time's quite interesting in the sort of mix of it as well, and just being able to return to play, I suppose. And of the many wonderful things you've done, and I know this is a little bit like asking you to choose a favourite record, so it's kind of impossible. But I wondered if you might be able to tell us a story of one of the favourite projects that you've made with older people, or a particular story of a transformation that you found particularly moving.
There are so many at this point. Because I produce, so Bielton used to have 3,500 different events every year. And you'd be going, oh, what's the best one? And it's a really great question to get asked, because best is different. So best might be the glamorous thing with the big national whatever, or it might be something that happened that was very tiny but huge. So I was thinking about this a little, and there was a project that we did that was quite small, which was about, we discovered a care home where people knitted, and we hung around for a bit, and we knitted some scarves, and then they took them to local Oxfam, and Oxfam sold them. And this was in a small village. And what was amazing about that was the people that were in that, that were very frail but could knit in that care home, suddenly became contributors. They became the people that made the thing, that raised the money for whatever Oxfam was raising money for. And that changed the perception. And I love that project because it did that. It did that shift in perception. And when I think about the projects that I like most, in a way, they've done that in very different ways. So I started an orchestra with the National Concert Hall in Dublin called Blow the Dust Off Your Trumpet. Now
known as... I love the slightly carry-on title.
It's great. Blow the Dust Off Your Trumpet, Mrs.
I love it. You can imagine Charles Hawtrey saying that, can't you?
Yeah. Wandering in at the door with like the very dust trombone. And it was that's why we started it. We started it because there were people with instruments that they weren't playing, or they didn't get to play with other people. And the concert hall, which is brilliant, but all their projects were for kids. And so, fair play, they decided that they wanted to try this, and we invited people along, and people came in and they got involved and they made a concert. And then the concert hall decided they'd keep it going because they liked it and it was good fun and people animated and they were learning lots. And then about, 6 months after that, they rang me up and they said, we've got a bit of a problem because the people in the Dusties keep coming in and using the photocopying machine. They just wander into the office, and when we say we're kind of busy, they say, well, but we are the orchestra of the National Concert Hall. It's our building. And so that was fantastic, because that made it very different than working with kids. Kids would never do that, but adults will do that and know why they're doing it. And so the conversation became between the concert hall, the institution, and the Dusties that were using it, about how they would work together and where they would play. And they ended up playing on the railway station on a Friday evening, and they ended up doing the nice concerts with the Posh Frogs, and some people ended up being a band, and they went off brass band and did concerts and gigs, and all of this stuff grew out of it. And so that project was great because it changed the perception of what people were expected to do, but it became this seed from which lots of other things grew. And we just did another project last September, which came in a way from that project, because we developed a relationship with the concert hall. And so we started working a food bank about 2 years ago, hung out for ages, eating sausages and eggs, like, with nobody speaking to us and looking at us like we were mad. And, you know,
you were having a nice little feast there. So
I got breakfast every Friday. It was fab. And I loved what was going on in this gym. So it took place in a half a gym in a kind of interesting part of Dublin, and so there were all these people that lived on their own and were quite, you know, deemed to be isolated because they kind of were, maybe didn't have the best of housing. They would come in for breakfast on a Friday, and once you got to know them, everybody has a story, as you know. And so we ended up writing some songs for a guy called Sean Miller, who's a songwriter, and we spent about a year doing that. And then people would perform their songs, and we got a little band together to do it, and then somebody else started another music session in the same place. And then we kept it going because we thought there was something else going on. And then we persuaded the symphony orchestra, who were now based in the concert hall. And then this became a full-on massive production with the people from the Breakfast Club and the people from the National Symphony Orchestra. And it is possible to cry while playing a violin, I've discovered. Oh. It was incredibly emotional. And we fed 1,100 people breakfast in the concert hall and did a 55-minute concert. And so the relationship between different parts of town has changed as well. So yeah. That's what I love about those projects, is you never quite know where they're going to go.
What's really wonderful about that, and we'll come back to it later on in our conversation, I hope, is when I hear you talk about that, it makes me look forward to age, to being older. And I know that the best of those stories make other people look forward to it. And I actually think that's a really important part of it, so that it spreads, so that instead of there being this dread and apprehension and all of that stuff, that there can be an idea that there is a different way of being older, both for yourself, but also for friends that you might have that getting older, or your parents, or whatever that is. So I think those, I mean, they're amazing things, aren't they? All of those stories. They're just
brilliant. Yeah.
And the magic of transformation and potentiality and things growing and all of that stuff is beautiful. And before we come back to the positive things, which is lovely, a little bit in relation to what you were saying, as I said to you earlier, obviously, I didn't anticipate, as none of us did, a global pandemic to be part of the conversation. But as it's so present, it is present, you know,
it will be
for some time. And I think what's happened, so I'm in the midst, Dominic, of a project with the Royal Albert Hall and with a sheltered housing unit in West London. And I've worked with them for a couple of years. So we've had to sort of try and do it through the post. I think I spoke to you about it, and we're seeing how that's developing. I've been aware because of that, because I've got a lot of older friends through working over the few years, that, gosh, some people are cross that they're being made to feel vulnerable when they don't feel vulnerable. They actually feel very fit and robust.
Yeah.
Other people feel like the news is telling them they're going to die every day, and that's producing huge anxiety. Being reminded of death and dying when it's not part of their daily thinking, it isn't necessarily, just because you're older, it doesn't mean you're sort of looking at the Grim Reaper in the mirror every day. And I'm aware of that, as I'm assuming that you are. It's not just older people, it's anyone that might be deemed vulnerable because of an existing health condition is being reminded of danger, present danger. And I'm wondering about the impact that's having on older people's mental health. And if you have any thoughts about how we can all help each other through that and with that.
So there are a few things. The first one is that language really matters.
Okay.
And you know how people are referred to, what they're told, really, really matters. And the way that I see this at the moment is my mum and dad are in Manchester. My dad is in a residential care home. He's got advanced Alzheimer's and he's been in lockdown for ages. My mum can't get to see him, but my mum I talk to every day. And I watch the BBC News. And I listen to the Irish news, and I work with care homes over here. And both care homes are having a terrible, terrible time. The language that comes in Ireland about lockdown is different. So what they say here is people were invited to cocoon themselves.
Oh, that's a lovely word.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
And at some point, there was that whole conversation about, well, some people are being a bit bold and going out all the time and bumping into each other. And should that be policed? And so the conversation here was, well, it's a republic and we police by choice. We police ourselves by choice. So you're invited as a member of this republic to do that. Whereas when I listen to the language in England, it's very different. So it just makes me remember how careful we've got to be about language, first bit. And the second bit is about language around hope. So do we think of this as lockdown or do we think of it as cocooning? If it's cocooning, is it more like nesting out for the winter? In which case, what am I going to grow? And what can come out of that? So there's that piece of it. I think it's very difficult. One of the ways that I see the mental health challenge is when I go for a walk, which I do maybe once a day. We don't go out very much and I've been in the same two rooms for 6 weeks. But I see what we've nicknamed the COVID waltz, which is where you're not quite sure what the social distance is and you do this weird kind of dance. And so obviously things are changing in the way people perceive each other. And I think we just have to navigate our way through that incredibly carefully and very gently and with great kindness.
Yeah.
And that's probably about as much as we can do for now.
Yeah, it's very close, isn't it? It's because we're in the thick of it as well. I don't know how possible or even useful analysis is at this point, but it feels important to for us just all to be chatting and saying to each other how can we help. And I've been very encouraged by how eager people are to help actually each other outside and below and beyond the kind of official narrative. There's been a lot of kindness, I think.
This my neuroscientist friends, the ones with the pointy heads, they talk about flight and fright. So flight and fright is like the first thing that happens, but that's like a wave and it crashes over you and it's very quickly replaced by tend and befriend. And so that's, you know, people gather together and support. And I've been thinking about that. And also I did a lot of work with artists that work in conflict zones. And there's a professor in Manchester called James Thompson who did this XY graph of art that's made in conflict. And he says, at the point where the two lines of the graph cross, the sort of right angle bit, where the bomb's dropping on your head, there is no art made. Nothing happens. But if you move along the bottom line, which is time, so like an hour later, a day later, a week later, a month later, a year, a decade, or if you move along the other line, the up-down line, which is distance, so you're next door to the bomb dropping on your head, you're in the next town, the next village, the next country, the next continent, you can map out the kind of art that gets made. And so I found that really helpful to think about what's happening now. Am I in the crisis? Am I near the crisis? Is it a bit later than? And also, is it happening here? So the COVID is in an extraordinary thing because it's happening all over the world, but not at the same time. So outbreaks and impacts are different depending on where you are. And I think that's going to gradually be a way that we can give ourselves hope, is that we can see how people get through. We can learn from how important song is in Italy. And we can learn how important it is to come out once a week and make noise. We can learn. We are amazing things because we learn.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I think I've been sort of staggered and very sort of encouraged by the creative response of everyone, not just people that identify as artists, but everyone, you know. Most of the windows around here have turned into little galleries with very funny pictures on cartoons and pictures and scraps of poems and just very funny chalk writing on the pavements, you know.
Isn't it amazing how much people want to play?
Yeah.
Now, if there's time or... And maybe play is a whole heap more important than most people think.
Gosh, absolutely. I've been writing about it actually last week, and I just, I unfortunately didn't make it to Michael Rosen's exhibition at the Wellcome Trust, but I bought his book on play, in which he sort of unpacks multi-generational play, you know, and the importance of it. And there's some lovely, Nat Zolak, he's got a kind of University of Play, which is about adult play and... mental health practice and stuff. So there's loads of brilliant things going on, and it feels like some of it's about permission. It's like, again, going back to aging, that we are allowed to do certain things at certain ages, aren't we? And then we're not allowed. And actually, children don't get to a very, very high age before they're told they're not allowed to do certain things.
Yeah.
So all of that reclaiming, jumping back in puddles and drawing windows.
And just not being the story that you're told that you should be, or you think you can play with your story. And maybe that's one of the great things about this, the great resetting, is that it's a chance to play with all sorts of stories. The story we tell about ourselves, the story we tell about other people, about the way that we live. That's an amazing opportunity.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And it's been taken, I think. Just to go to a slightly more concerning place for a moment, you've probably had the same, but I've had quite a lot of direct news coming from care homes by friends that are there and working there. And some of the concern, certainly in the UK and from care workers, one of their concerns is that older people's lives are being valued less. But one of the sort of good positive conversations that are coming out of that is, okay, so what can we do about this then, as we've shone a light on it? What good can come of it? And through the news and through what's been happening with care homes, in a way, there's been an invitation to go into a place And it's literally on our screens in the mornings. We see these places. We see the workers. We find out how little they earn, how hard their jobs are. We see the people that are in there who are happy to be seen. And so we are more aware, I think, of the challenges for residents and staff, those of us who don't have friends or relatives in care homes. Do you think, as this is sort of, as a light has been shone on that, those care homes and those challenges, that we could hope for any positive changes as a result of the pandemic?
I really hope so. And I think that's one of the things that I'm starting to really kind of focus on as much as I can. So the way I think about it at the moment is there is health and there is care, different things. And then healthcare, the kind of big industrial delivery of it, is really based on acute systems. So it's based on A&E. It's based on the fact you break a bone, you go into a particular building, they fix the bone and they send you back out. And it's brilliant at that. It's got incredibly efficient at doing that. It's not good at chronic conditions, things that you have to live with, arthritis and MS and mental health. And it turns out it's really bad at pandemics. It's because it's not a great idea to put all the sick people in one place and they just all get sick. And when you look at the infection rate of the poor, brave, heroic, amazing people who just get up every morning and go and put their scrubs on and go to work, it's really not great for them. So that model of putting everybody, all the sick people in one place, maybe isn't the best. And what I'm hoping is that opens up a conversation about the fact that maybe not everybody is sick in the same way, and maybe sick is the wrong word. So if we think about, you know, you and I have worked a lot with people who are in the disability world. Mm-hmm. And some of the ways people are made disabled is by the way we build buildings or institutions or systems. And we know from that world we can do it better. We know we can do, you know, we can reduce the amount of challenge that people face. And I think we can do that with people who are old and frail. And it's partly about design, and it's partly about having fun, and maybe it's about making streets of rubber, or I don't know, lots of flower beds, or it's about dreaming harder. And so what I'm really hoping is that now that there's a light through really horrible, difficult circumstances shone on that, that we can start to do that better. And I'm really glad you mentioned the carers, because and levels of pay and stuff. We need to kind of bring care back into the middle of what we do. It's like if we measure what we do in terms of economy and we don't think about measuring it in terms of care, maybe we got it wrong. Maybe we look at the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I've been really pleased that so many of those care workers have been given a platform, have been allowed to speak, have been given the time to say everything they want to say. I find that immensely encouraging, really humbling as well. And so I do feel at the moment cautiously optimistic about that and what changes might possibly happen. Later on tonight, I'm talking to an architect about cities of the future, Dom. So I shall mention your dreaming harder and ask him to do that. He's very interested in that kind of thing. So I'll let you know about that.
Yeah.
In terms of our, I just wonder what your hopes might be for the future in terms of societal and cultural changes which might happen in relation with attitude towards ageing and towards older people in general. What would you like to hope to see change as kind of headlines in terms of all of our attitudes towards our own ageing, ourselves when we're older and other older people?
Yeah, so I think about this in kind of othering and belonging. So I think people do this really strange thing, which I don't understand, which is they other their older selves. They you know, when I used to talk about, I do work with older people, they go, that's lovely. That's lovely for my granny, auntie, somebody, but not for me. And I'd be looking at people and going, yeah, but you're 60 and, you know, you're kind of in the area of, you know, something's going to happen soon. So I think, I hope that people start to think about themselves when they are older in a different kind of way and embrace it. Learn to fall in love with your older self. But I'm kind of hoping something else happens as well. And because this pandemic is happening all over the place at the same time, and partly because I'm incredibly lucky. So I've spent over the last 6 weeks at least 2 or 3 hours a day online with somebody in another country. who is at a different stage of pandemic and lives in a very different place, whether they're in Khayelitsha, the temporary town in South Africa, or whether they're in Delhi, or whether they're in Kentucky, or wherever they are. And they are all affected, albeit differently because of their circumstances, by the same issues. And they are all looking and needing and seeking the same thing, connection and where home is, and to feel safe and a chance. And they're all doing things like playing and trying to figure out how they can play music to more than like their cat. And, you know, so I think one of the great things that might happen is people can start to see themselves in others as well as fall in love with their older selves. And I think that might be amazing.
Yeah. Do you feel that the experience of this in a way has introduced us to people who we might normally, not deliberately or with any malice, sort of other, separate from us, different from us, that in a way this is, even though we're kept at a social distance, we have to know what 2 metres means, that in other ways, actually, we've got in touch with each other more and with different kinds of people more.
I think what it's done is everybody feels vulnerable in a similar kind of way. So there is this, I'm trying to change the way that I think about COVID. I'm trying to fall in love with the virus, because I kind of think it's just out doing its thing. It's a natural organism, and it's just out doing its thing. And what that means is it sort of affects everybody. There are people who are, at least in terms of what we know about it so far, more and less at risk. There are things you can and cannot do. Like, you know, so I'm really lucky, I can kind of shut the doors and stay in for a bit, but I've got a whole pile of friends who can't. And you can do those things depending on how lucky you are. But otherwise, it's the same challenge for all of us. And when there's a war, it's not. It's some other individual, some other person. But this is a different thing. It's much more like climate change. Mm. It's much more the one thing affects all of us. So can we, as the collective people living on the blue pebble, floating in a rock in space, how do we get our heads around that? Because actually, my actions are, you know, I could potentially be the person that carries the virus to you. So I have a responsibility now for you in the same way you have a responsibility for me. And that is a whole new amazing thing.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. Quite a few people have used the boats as a metaphor. And a friend of mine said the other day, it feels like we're in the same sea. We're in different boats. Some of us have got a leaky dinghy. Other ones have got a yacht. But actually, we are in the same sea. And yeah, I thought that was a really useful, you know, Stella Duffy, it was a sort of really useful extension of that metaphor. And extraordinary, difficult in many ways, of course, but also extraordinary to live through this time when we have something that unifies us. It is also a gift, as well as being terrible and all the rest of it. So going back to, I love the idea of falling in love with your older self. That's very nice. It made me think about when kids get excited about being grown up, like they want to be grown up. They don't, and you think, oh, if only you knew, you'd enjoy being a kid. But they're like, no, I really want to be 12 or whatever. I was just thinking, I wonder if there's that it's possible or desirable, in your opinion, to look forward to being older. And is that part of developing a better relationship with our aging selves, that we can look forward to? I don't mean that it means we don't enjoy ourselves now.
Yeah.
But I just wondered if there's anything positive in saying, actually, you know what, I'm really looking forward to that time because...
So I think there are a couple of things. So one is the association with being old and dying. And when I hang out with people who are old, quite often they've kind of got their head around the dying bit. They've had that conversation with themselves and they know that's going to happen. So now they're going to get into the living bit. And so it's not an issue in the same way as it might be for somebody who is younger. as it is for them. They're kind of, yeah, it's going to happen. So, like, okay, dealt with it. And now I'm going to just live and enjoy. So it's the richness of living in old age. It's that bit, I think, is the thing to look forward to. And then sometimes I spend a bit of time going, well, what is it then? Because, like, you know, your knees go and your back goes. But you can't eat the same foods and some of your friends have died. And then I think, actually, no, it's guile. It's the ability to be cheeky. It's the ability to be really, 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 really informed about people because you spend a lot of time watching what people really do. And you can just be really, yeah, bold in a really clever way. And it might be that you have a kind of, you know, a gag running, a joke for yourself. But actually, that's, yeah, that's kind of fun. You know, when we work with people quite often, they turn up and they turn up just to give out. And they spend all day just going, oh. I just think that must be so much fun.
So freeing. It reminds me, you know that poem, which is kind of dated, not very well in a way, When I'm an Old Woman, I Will Wear Purple. Mm-hmm. But at the heart of that is that, isn't it? It's like, you might say, when I'm an old woman, I shall be cheeky. Or when I'm an old woman, you know, I shall swear. Or
I know it won't put up with this anymore. Why would they put up with this anymore? Yeah. You know, don't need to.
Very liberal.
So I think... It's interesting what
you said about dying, because yesterday I was interviewing some colleagues of mine who have done a lot of work and projects about death, who are both young, relatively, and I think they'd be really interested to hear you saying that, because we talked about, you know, sort of discussing existential angst and that kind, you know, how do you cope, how does hope fit in with the certainty of death? So it's really interesting to hear you say that.
Yeah. So there's two things that pop into my head. One is cultural framing. So so people that believe in reincarnation don't really have the same hang up that people that think we might go to heaven or hell have. Right? It's like it's a different kind of thing. And I have a friend who lives in Dublin, Liam, and he said this beautiful thing one day. We were walking down the street and he said, this kind of came up in conversation because he's about 78 or something. I mean, not that you'd know it, but he is. He said, you know, when you're like a baby and you're still not born yet and you're kind of floating around and you pop out and you have no idea that there are people that will hold you and wipe the amniotic fluid off your face and make sure you're warm. And he said, I think about death like that. We've no idea what's on the other side. So why wouldn't there be lots of lovely people who just want to look after us and nang and be nice and give us biscuits and cups of tea?
It's very nice. And it's a beautiful, what a lovely man. And what a lovely thought. But it's also, what's lovely about that is he's given himself permission to think that might be, as well as anything else might be. And to give yourself permission to be comforted by a possibility is really beautiful. It's playful as well. Back to playful. Yeah. And back to guile and all the rest of it. That's lovely. And sort of talking a little bit more kind of personally, I suppose, now, but about sort of personal and work things, really. I've been thinking a lot, because it's obviously very much in all of our lives and it's in the news and it's around us, that this pandemic and recent events has brought lots of loss in all kinds of ways and lots of grief and suffering in all kinds of ways. And I, you know, I don't wish to make light of that, and there is much more to come, I'm sure. But I also genuinely think that it has gifted us lots of things, and some positive changes, really profound ones. And I'm sort of asking everyone, because I'm interested, if you've noticed any changes that have happened as a result of this, in your life and in your work, that you might like to keep hold of, that you'd like to continue when it's over, or perhaps experiment with continuing. And what those things might be, if there are any.
So one thing is that it makes institutions porous. Crisis makes institutions fluid. So what organisations need has changed, and so they will. You can pick up the phone and talk to institutions. And so we're trying to work in Dublin across institutions. We're trying to do a very simple singing project, and we thought long and hard about how you can learn a song online, sure, but if you don't have online, how can you do it by post, and how can you do it by? And then we looked at all the national institutions, and then we kind of dreamt about ways that we might join them all up together. So may or may not come off at the moment, which is partly why I feel like I've got one foot on the accelerator and one on the pedal.
Yeah.
Yeah. But if it does come off, then we could do this lovely thing where you phone up the emergency phone number. And if you don't need food or you don't need medical intervention, but you fancy it, someone might write you a lullaby and we can get a group of kids to sing that lullaby to you by you phoning in. And we can drop things out through the postal service. So amazing things have happened here. Like the postal service designed and sent out colouring books to kids that were about ways of navigating through the COVID crisis, aimed at sort of 6 to 11 year olds. And that Postal Service just did it themselves.
Oh.
They just got designers and off it went. Brilliant stuff. So the big state institutions here have started to do that, and we're in a very different place than this. So there's that bit. And then the other thing that's more personal, I think, is there's been like these phases of pandemic. So people frantically trying to put stuff online, everybody spending ages online, massive amounts of tweets and chat, and then people just shutting down and withdrawing, and then this kind of roller coaster, and now, at least for me, it's the phone's gone a bit quiet, and it's like, phew. And somewhere in that, there was also this stage where people started talking about the great ideas for the future, and it all got very quite ego-y. And another friend of mine was saying that she works with people that research into do research, and now there's all these grants for research, and it's the same research as before, only with COVID stuck on the front end of it. And it's kind of like the replication of the same patterns and process. And I started to feel that that was just a bit noise and it was too much. And then I read this thing, which was a little short interview with Arvo Part, the composer and musician. And he said, he was asked about, you know, the impact of this on his life. And he went, you know, he said, I kind of think I'm a bit like those 15th century woodcarvers in churches that spent as much time carving the back of the pew that nobody would see as they did doing the front. And I just go about my business. I just do my practice. I kind of do the thing that I do. Sure, this stuff happens, but actually it's the intentional labor of love that I bring to everything that I do all the time that is my consistency. That's what makes my boat, regardless of what the sea is. And I just thought that was kind of lovely. Very simple, very, yeah, I do my craft as well as I can do it. And
I think that's true. I also think some people have found it much easier than others. And I'm freelance, and I have noticed amongst my friends that are working for institutions, there's a really big difference in panic levels. And so just in defense of people who are bunging stuff online, I think some of that was about just finding a way to survive, because most of us, the vast majority of freelancers, lost all of their income between the 14th and the 24th of March. And so I think it's important that, as well as, like you said in a Facebook post, I absolutely agreed with you, we can't expect to go back to normal. That's absolutely right. But we have to extend our compassion in all directions, everywhere. And that, you know, some people are being a bit sort of, it's almost like some people have seen it as a marketing opportunity. And I found some of that a bit challenging. And then I thought, but I don't know what that person's going through or how much money they've got left. So that feels important too. And some people, it's beautiful that that man, metaphorically or otherwise, can carve the back of the chair. But honestly, Dom, I don't think some people can hardly get out of bed.
Yeah. No, I agree with you, and thank you for kind of calling it.
No, I don't mean to tell you off. I'm calling myself out on it as well, because when I listened to Donald Trump yesterday, he was talking about ingesting disinfectant, and it's hard to listen to. But I honestly mean this. I thought our compassion needs to go to him too, and to everybody. And that's a really challenging thing to say, I know, but I just think actually, in order to move forward and to evolve, and I think it needs nothing short of that, the next bit of the world, we have to love all everyone really hard.
So I realised the other day there are things that I don't think about just yet because I'm not ready. And some of them are about the industry that I've worked in, or the way that I've worked since I was 14. to do with making festivals and hanging around with big numbers of people in fields, and that for the foreseeable future is gone. There are no licenses available here until October, which means no work until January, which means all of that, all of the infrastructure, gone. And I spend, there'll be a couple of days a week when somebody phones me who's a musician that is just going, what do I do next? There is, and you know, and I freelance. I am self-employed. Don't get a wage from anybody. So I have no work paid for the rest of the year.
It's perilous, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really precarious. And so the kind of carving the church pew analogy thing is about what it is that you can find in yourself to navigate every day. And that can be incredibly tough for everybody at some point, and always for someone at some time. And loving everybody, that is hard.
No, I know.
But big. I kind of get it. I get, yeah.
Yeah, they're sort of big and they're grand things, but I think it relates to what I wanted to ask you next, which is another sort of big question. Not to say that I fail in loving everybody, but I strive for that. And I also have to remind myself everybody's fighting a battle I know nothing about daily, you know, minute by minute. But I wanted to talk to you about, obviously there's been a lot of talk about, let's not go back to normal. Normal wasn't working for anybody. Let's create a new normal, which is partly why I sort of brought that up. Because I've been thinking about what we need in order to make a better world. Yeah. And if this is an opportunity to make one for you, if we were to create a new normal, if you like, what would be the key things in that new normal that you would hope for?
So I suppose the first thing is I'm not sure there's a normal. I think there's lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of normals.
Very good.
And I kind of think that's the bit I'd hope for, is that we kind of go, there isn't a normal, and therefore you're not failing if you don't live up to it. Or, you know, it's joy or happiness or contentment or being at ease or whatever that thing is. Being kind is possibly a better thing. Is there a new kind, maybe? Yeah. So I kind of think that's important, that there isn't our way. There are lots and lots and lots and lots.
Yeah.
And maybe that helps us, because there's a thing packed in that new normal, I think, which is about doing better. And I think we just do different, and I'd like to do better different. So one of the things that's lovely about being here at the moment is the greening of the city. So because there's less cars and petrol, and then the green life is just bubbling up. And it's also spring. So the greening of cities really feels like a real thing that you could really talk to your architects this evening.
I know. I was going to say, me and my friend Dominic were talking about that. Yeah, no, it's great. Because we're, as you said, Dom, we're seeing it literally out of our windows right now. It's happening.
Yeah.
There's foxes lying like ginger biscuits in the middle of the A2.
It's just fantastic. And it just makes such a different kind of sensation. And then you go, well, actually, if we want to keep the greening bit of the cities, then we have to figure out the transport bit of the cities. And then can we figure out the transport bit of the cities with solar panel planes or something?
Yes.
And it was amazing last week when all of a sudden we weren't an oil economy because nobody needed it.
Yeah.
And we weren't making,
and the value plunged.
Yeah.
And we, it's interesting relating to what you were saying about the climate change, the concern about climate change, when we were all being told that it wasn't possible to shift this juggernaut, and lo and behold, we've done it.
It is. Yeah. Kind of amazing. So many amazing things that it might take us a while to figure out what the amazing things are.
Yeah.
I quite like the kind of slowing down, I think. There's something about not running around to do the same thing that everybody else is doing all the time because everybody else is doing it. So can we slow down, and then can we do something that's important to us better?
I think that's lovely. It relates to, circles back to what you said so beautifully about the new normal, that there doesn't need to be one kind of correct or one kind of normal or one kind of better. I think that's a really beautiful sort of thing to think about in the future, that there are lots of versions of, there are lots of ways to be people, which is really nice.
And maybe the other bit is just that and there's something that kind of goes with that, which I think is also about being really hopeful. So if you want to change something, you usually have to take something out. You have to stop doing something. Yeah. So you don't get from here to the new normal in a day. You get there, it's going to take a bit of time. So if that's about greening cities, then we need to plant some new flower beds, then we have to plant the flower beds, and we have to wait. And maybe that's to do with the slowing down. And, you know, so not where do we want to get to by Christmas, but where do we want to get to in three Christmases' time? And can we slow down enough just to be easy with that
process? That's lovely to let that happen.
Mm.
And so lastly, first of all, in general terms, this might be too difficult. Sometimes this is a really difficult question to answer, I think. But when you feel, just for yourself in your own life, if you're feeling kind of flattened and pessimistic and despairing, what's your sort of go-to to reignite hope for yourself? Or to, I don't really like using the word positive, because it doesn't necessarily have to be positivity, but just to make you feel that there's hope.
So I think... one thing that's really useful is that I've learned there are days when you cannot deliver. You just can't. You have to stop. Go to bed. That's okay. Just curl up. Stop. It's fine. And give yourself time to kind of reset and figure your way out, or give yourself time to go and do something completely different and talk to friends, or go and, you know, dance around. Whatever it is, just give yourself time to breathe. And give yourself a bit of time to daydream. And you can't always do that, because sometimes being depressed is also being in a crisis, and there's food to get. But if you can, even if you don't do it in a small way, give yourself time to do that. Give yourself time to dream. And I take great inspiration from studying carnival. I love carnival, and I love the idea that you can put on a mask and be somebody else, or, you know, change your hairdo, or put on a pair of platforms, or just dress up and feel what it's like to, because I think we navigate by feeling a lot more than we talk about. So dress up as something else, feel to be something else, and then try that feeling on for size, and then maybe you kind of fit into it. And part of that trying something on is to do with, you know, I think rational is a bit overrated, really. I think because we navigate by feeling, we do things all the time that are a bit irrational. But and I was reading a bit about sort of cellular behavior, which I really understand badly, but I think of it like swallows. So when you see murmurations, we're made of lots of cells, and those cells have behaviors. They absorb some things and they push other things out, and they congregate together. And we are basically one big collection of cells, and the big collection of cells pulls us along. It's the kind of irrational thing. So it gives me great pleasure and comfort, I suppose, to think that actually I'm not necessarily in charge of the ship in the way that I think I am.
Well, there's humility in that, which is a useful humility, isn't there?
Yeah, that's right.
A kind of acceptance.
Yeah, it's like, that's all right. Just, I can't always get there, but if I can, that's helpful.
But lovely advice. But I wondered, if you were to write down the things that you've missed or yearned for during this lockdown, what one or some of those things might have been?
Yeah, I think I yearn for street markets. I like Deptford Market on a Wednesday. Right? I miss that. I miss the chance of wandering down the street and seeing people bringing stuff out of their houses and just people all congregated together. And I think it might be a while before we get back to that. A friend of mine said this really smart thing. We were talking about life after the really big peak of the AIDS epidemic in the 80s, and before now, before PrEP. And he said, you know, gay men had to learn to be intimate again. So it wasn't that we're not going to be intimate. They had to come at it with different rules and a different kind of education. He said, and I think maybe that's a thing that is quite hopeful, that we can learn to adapt. We're amazing human beings, we adapt, so we will figure it out eventually.
We're super good at doing that, hence the thriving. Hence the success. And lastly, you've reminded me of Deptford Market.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
No, I remember being down there one Wednesday with you when I nearly bought a hurdy-gurdy and you got into a really long conversation with a lady about her, the contents of her trolley.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yeah. Yeah, just like, it's the best thing in the world, really.
Yeah, it's a wonderful, just, wonderful.
Right.
So looking forward to that. Yeah, lastly, just wanted to ask, because people will be listening, obviously, I'm sure fascinated by your work and amazing projects that you do. Just wondered if you could let us know where we might be able to find you or join in or connect with you or contact you.
So the easiest way to track what I'm doing is either you have a nosy around the LinkedIn, but creativeagingInternational.com is the website. And it's kind of a bit clunky as websites go, but you generally get an idea of what I'm doing from there.
International.com and or LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. Lovely. That's brilliant. Thank you so much for talking to me.
Pleasure talking to you.
Thank you very much for listening. If you carry on listening for just a little while longer, you'll hear a sing-along that I enjoyed with the residents of Sheltered Housing in Lewisham in one of the projects that I did with Lewisham Homes and with Meet Me at the Albany. And you'll hear right there how, as Dominic so rightfully said, the secret weapon is joy.
Put your sweet lips.